when I think about feeding fat, the way I've always looked at it is you have a couple different parts. You start out with your basal fat level. So corn silage, you know, corn grain, small amount of fat, but we're feeding so much of it, it's bringing in quite a few grams of fat. And then when I'm going to first start increasing dietary fat, then I'm going to start looking at oil seeds, what I call rumen available fat. That's usually our more economical sources. They do come with risk, though, because that unsaturated fat can cause milk fat depression. You know, we've had a lot of interest in high-lake soybeans recently, and that really comes from that allows us to use more of that rumen available fat before we're putting ourselves at too much of a risk of milk fat depression. And then the last part is that dry fat supplement that's going to come in last, and that's where really you're selecting to balance out your fatty acid profile.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Hi-D from DSM Firmenich optimizes vitamin D levels to increase milk yield, enhance calcium to phosphorus ratio, and strengthen immunity. With early detection in health, reproduction, and feeding, SmaxTech future-proofs your dairy operation. Priority IAC, the only company bringing the fields of microbiology and nutrition together. Adiseo USA, producers of SmartAmine M and MilkPay.com. Modern solutions for modern cows with AHV. Contact us to beat biofilm-related issues in your herd. Lallemand Animal Nutrition, partnering in microbial solutions for a changing world.
Welcome, everyone, to this episode of the Dairy Podcast Show. I'm your host for today, Gail Carpenter, the State Dairy Specialist with Iowa State University. I'm joined today by Dr. Kevin Harvatine, who is a professor of nutritional physiology at Penn State. Dr. Harvatine did his bachelor's degree at Penn State, a master's degree at Michigan State, and his PhD at Cornell University. I always think Kevin's one of the first people that comes to mind when I think about milk fat and how we can maximize milk fat or optimize milk fat. And so I'm excited to jump in and talk about that a little bit more today. So welcome to the podcast, Dr. Harvatine.
Thank you. And milk fat's my favorite topic.
Very good. Yeah. I always wonder, I was thinking about this a little bit. Do you ever get tired of talking about any of these topics?
Well, so what's great about milk fat is there's so many different things that relate back into it. And I often think milk fat's central to what we do, and everything we do kind of comes back to understanding it. But we work across a lot of different areas, and I often think I'm a little bit too scattered, or know I'm too scattered to kind of thinking about a lot of things. But that's really why I like the areas that you're not just thinking about one thing. Everything from, you know, feeding behavior and rumen function, physiology, it all relates and has an impact.
We ask our guests to send us a list of possible topics beforehand. And one of the things that you sent that I thought was kind of interesting was the challenge of defining a requirement for dietary fat in dairy cattle. So do dairy cattle have a true requirement for dietary fat? If they do, how would we go about identifying what that is? Talk us through that a little bit.
Yeah, and I think dietary fat's really been overlooked for a long time. Part of that is such a small part of the diet. And you start thinking about, geez, I'm adding 1% of this to the diet. How can that really be having a major impact versus the amount of NDF and starch that we have in there? And the challenge on saying that there's actual requirement is that the cow doesn't officially need fat. She can make fat from VFAs mostly. But then you say, okay, we have this cow that we've bred for really high production. We've bred her for a lot of milk fat production. So now, is there a certain level of fat that is optimal to allow her to meet that genetic potential? And we really don't even have a great number to say, this is what you should be feeding. And, you know, Don Palmquist back in 1980 kind of proposed, well, feed the cow, I think, is twice as much fat as what the milk fat she's making. Well, we couldn't possibly do that with the level of milk fat that we have today, right? So we're really in this conundrum that we can't feed very much because we start screwing up the rumen. The cow is very limited in her fat digestibility compared to non-ruminants, right? But then she has this really high demand. So I think that that cow is kind of in a pretty tight spot of trying to do what she's genetically capable of, but still with all these other limitations.
Adiseo, a global leader in nutritional solutions and the provider of SmartAmine N, the best-in-class rumen-protected methionine product for dairy producers who want to optimize milk production, capture more value from their components, and maintain their lifetime performance of their herds. For more product information and to calculate your return on investment when you balance your feed with amino acids, go to milkpay.com.
So if we're looking at a dietary fat requirement, are you looking at total fat? Are you looking at crude fat? Are you looking at RUFLs? What are you kind of analyzing when you're looking at fat in the diet?
So in part of like, so we have some USDA grant right now that we're really trying to go after this of saying, can we find an optimal level? And I have to say, we've sort of failed in that cow is adaptable, right? So especially if you start looking at these really high producing cows and you say, how is she doing this? She's limited in the amount of fat that we're giving her. She's making up for that with quite a bit of de novo synthesis. And that's why I think if you look at herds that are making really good milk yield, really good milk fat, they're not just getting the fat part of their diet right. The fiber, rumen fermentation part is really important to support all that de novo synthesis. You know, when I think about feeding fat, the way I've always looked at it is you have a couple different parts. You start out with your basal fat level, so corn silage, you know, corn grain, small amount of fat, but we're feeding so much of it, it's bringing in quite a few grams of fat. And then when I'm going to first start increasing dietary fat, then I'm going to start looking at oil seeds, what I call rumen available fat. That's usually our more economical sources. They do come with risk, though, because that unsaturated fat can cause milk fat depression. You know, we've had a lot of interest in high-oleic soybeans in recently, and that really comes from that allows us to use more of that rumen-available fat before we're putting ourselves at too much of a risk of milk fat depression. And then the last part is that dry fat supplement that's going to come in last, and that's where really you're selecting to balance out your fatty acid profile. And there's a lot of interest here to saying, well, we think about amino acids and as amino acids, right? Not just as protein. And can we get there with fatty acids? And, you know, we certainly know that individual fatty acids do different things, act differently. I think we're still at a point where we're in the learning phase. I think we have a certain amount of total dietary fat we should be looking at. We still need to keep an eye on rumen unsaturated fat, especially 18.2. And then the last part would be balancing out. Right now, I would be looking at 16 and 18 carbon fatty acids and saying, okay, we know there's a certain balance there that's going to put us in a spot to hit different targets depending on what we want to do.
So what about the rest of the diet? What about the rest of the diet that we're building? How does that impact biohydrogenation, milk fat synthesis?
Yeah, huge.
This is where it's hard to focus, right? Like,
yeah, and that's where, like, I think I frustrate everybody because people in the real world, right? They're always saying, well, what should I balance to for optimal situation to not have milk fat depression? And I don't give numbers because you can't have numbers, right? Because it's sort of that all those interactions that go on in the rumen set you up for a different level of biohydrogenation and risk for milk fat depression. So that's where it's kind of job security for our nutritionist, right? That we have to be looking at that individual herd, have to be looking at the forages and how those forages are acting, balancing out carbohydrate profiles. So it's really a balance of getting enough fiber to keep the rumen functioning well, having enough starch to come in. Starch is really important. I think we kind of traditionally have had this view that starch is just giving us propionate. It's not. It's giving us a lot of acetate to support milk fat also, but we can only push that so far before we start getting into problems. You look at sugars, you know, sugars can have a beneficial effect, stimulating some really good microbial populations that improve biohydrogenation. But we can also get too much of a good thing and have too much sugar there also. And then, you know, a lot of times nutritionists forget about the feeding behavior part. And we, for a couple of years, we're pretty focused on daily patterns of feed intake and how that impacts rumen. Because, you know, that cow is eating about 80% of her feed in, say, a 12-hour period of the day. And when she's been without feed, she can be very aggressive in feeding and causes basically slug eating. So it's not just about the diet, it's also about that feeding behavior, which is really impacted by feeding times on the farm, milking times, how long that cow's away from feed, how long that bunk is empty.
And stocking density can play a role in that too, right? There's been some research showing that as well.
Yeah. Miner Institute would have the best, the data that I know of there. Stocking density really having a big impact on both feeding behavior, but also ruminating behavior. I think they had identified rumination while lying down as really a key metric of rumen health that plays into risk for milk fat depression.
You talked about the daily patterns there a little bit, and I think And there's seasonal patterns too, right? I think that's so interesting. And sometimes when I think about it too hard, it makes me a little nervous because we, like our sample collection times, we tend to, you know, you sample right after feeding or right after milking or whatever. You kind of pick a time in the day that's your representative for whatever metric you're collecting. But then there's more research coming out that whatever it is, milk urea, nitrogen, milk fat, feeding behavior, all that. We have these diurnal patterns, but also seasonal patterns too, right? And now you're adding an extra layer on top of that where there's actually differences in feeding behavior in addition. So how do we, how do you begin from a research perspective to even pull some of this stuff apart?
Yeah, let's take the seasonal one there. So the first part is just knowing that the seasonal pattern's there. And I've been really recommending people, you know, sit down once a year, pull out the calendar and write on every month what your goal for fat and protein is. Because we know there's a seasonal pattern, highest January 1, lowest July 1, and it's about 0.3 units. Now, that might be actually getting a little bit bigger over time. We're trending towards that getting a little bit bigger. But that's the first is to plan out to know it's going to happen. But then the really hard one is start to say, can I manage out of this or is it going to create interactions with other things? Data from Miner Institute and Dave Barbano shows that most of that variation in milk fats actually coming from de novo fat synthesis, right? So then you start thinking, well, geez, that means my cow has a higher potential for milk fat in general, but de novo synthesis specifically in January. So now, should I be changing my diet? Should I be feeding my most digestible forages, making sure I'm not limiting that de novo synthesis? Now, we really don't have data on those interactions, but I think it kind of makes you think, how can I try to either manage out of that rhythm or make sure that I'm not shortcutting the opportunity of that biology. Same thing on the daily patterns. You know, I really think the way that we manage cows may often be out of sync with what that cow wants to do. Mm-hmm. And say, you know, I love steak. You wake me up at 3 a.m. and say, I have the world's greatest steak for you. I'm going to tell you, get lost. I don't want a steak, right? Well, our cow's the same way, right? So we go in and we say, okay, this is optimal way for us to manage this cow. This is a good time for us to milk the cow. This is a good time for us to feed the cow. And we've never asked the cow if she really wanted that to happen at those times, right? So we really don't have the answers there. But what I tell people is kind of watch the cows. And they'll tell you what their preference is just based on their behaviors. And, you know, I think we want those cows eating more evenly across the day. For a while, I was trying to get cows to eat during the overnight period. And I gave up on that because I realized that she just does not want to eat there. But if we can get her to be eating first thing in the morning, spreading intake across the day is a good thing. What I don't want to see is that that cow is out without feed for a long period of time. And now everybody is very aggressively eating a lot of feed all at once just because of that feeding time or milking time situation. So I think that's a big thing, is to watch those cows, especially in our large dairies. Now it's not just one series of events. It's every pen is under a different scheme, right?
Does that differ with robotic dairies versus parlor milk dairies, do you think?
Yeah. And, you know, I've looked at the robotic data a little bit, because at times I thought, well, maybe we could figure out some of the cow preferences. We have to be a little bit careful with that, because that's a bit of an artificial situation, because you're programming in when you're allowing her to be milked based on predicted milk yield. You know, stocking density is a really big influence there, because even though she may want to go get milked right now, if the line is too long, because everybody wants to. And then also, if we think about, I'm not a robotics expert, but you hear about the discussion, you're moving your view a little bit from saying I'm maximizing efficiency of this cow to maximizing efficiency of the robot, right? So then we have higher stocking densities. But I think it's something, again, to watch with those cows. I ran into some folks that had started dropping their partial mixed ration earlier in the day to kind of get those cows up in moving around and moving to the robot. I know there's a paper I often like to show the data from, where the cows, the lowest time that cows came to the robot was between like 5 and 7 in the morning. And I have to think, like, when do we traditionally think we have to milk cows? Well,
yep.
It's right in then, right? But if you think about the calf, a cow's nursing a suckling calf, the least active period of the day is probably going to be right before dawn, right? Because that's the coldest part of the day. Once the sun comes up, that calf's going to be active and suckling more. And we actually see that. You have higher milk yield in the morning and then lower milk yield at night. But milk fat and protein percents go the opposite. So you look at that robotic data and say, well, were the cows sleeping in, or was the farmer sleeping in? Because if I don't have to be there to milk, maybe I'm just going to sleep in till 9 o'clock to come and feed then. So I think those are some opportunities to, you know, watch what's going on the farm and kind of schedule things to balance that out between the cows and the facility equipment limitations.
How much of that is going to be impacted by day length? I know right now we're in the long days of the year as we're recording this, but I've even started to notice that the nights are coming more quickly. So how much of this is impacted by day length?
Yeah, what's really neat on the seasonal pattern, milk composition seems to be driven by lengthening and shortening days. And then milk yield is actually driven by the change in day length. So the change in day length is higher, it's biggest near the equinox. If you look at peak milk yield is April, just following spring equinox, the same thing, lowest is in September. So it seems like the cow is sensing both lengthening and shortening and the change in those day lengths. I always like showing there's grazing data, looking at feeding behavior, and those cows will eat right before sunset. And it's really interesting when you look in that the New Zealand seasonal data early in the season, you know, peak, they're eating right at sunset, that's later, and then sunset gets earlier, and they move their feeding time to match that. So they are getting those cues.
Maybe it's also that we need to be changing, or someday we might be changing our diets for January versus July, but maybe we're also living a little bit more into our own patterns of sunrise and sunset than, because that's what the cows are doing.
I think there'd be very good justification for looking at, again, on that the amount of de novo fat synthesis is considerably different across the year. So, you know, we started out talking about that we don't balance for a fatty acid requirement. We don't balance for a VFA requirement either, right? We calculate energy, but energy is really means nothing to the cow. It's really a nutrient requirement. So if we think about that de novo synthesis, she has a higher requirement for acetate in January than she does in July.
Maximize profitability and herd health with early detection in animal health, reproduction, and feeding. The most advanced bolus technology and professional support from agricultural experts make this possible with SmaxTech, the health management system that future-proofs your dairy operation.
Well, you've done a little bit of work feeding sodium acetate, right? Can you talk a little bit about that?
And I at least want to be careful about this because a lot of people's memory is that the acetate deficiency of milk fat depression, which was disproven many, many, many years ago, that when you get milk fat depression, it's not that you don't have enough acetate. It's the bioactive fatty acids that are being made that are decreasing the cow's ability to make milk fat. But what we noticed is we're doing some experiments giving acetate, and we got very consistent milk fat responses, and did a dose titration. It was like 600 grams is where we saw our maximal response in milk fat. And the responses varied between experiments, but I think that experiment, there's almost a third response. There's like 200 grams of milk fat with 600 grams of sodium acetate. In our hands has been very consistent. We've looked at interactions with different diets. So, you know, adding high unsaturated fat, higher fermentability, high and low starch. And we've seen milk fat responses in all those scenarios. And what's sort of a tough spot is you do that research and you'd like to say, okay, now we can justify going and feeding this, right? But in the current marketplace, it's just not economical. We're using food grade sodium acetate in our research studies. So I always say you, in the real world, you have to get your acetate the hard way, which is putting up good forages, having good fiber digestibility, getting good rumen function so that you have maximal acetate synthesis in the rumen. But it's been kind of a neat piece there.
I do want to kind of come back and talk about something you mentioned. So I remember learning about when I was taking all of my nutrition classes in undergrad, and it was some of your research that was getting cited, biohydrogenation induced milk fat depression, and learned about, okay, it's not an acetate shortage. It's not, but it seems like to me anyway, we have fewer farms struggling with true milk fat depression anymore. And now we're more concerned about what's the upper limit on milk fat? And we're seeing Holsteins produce milk fat at numbers we never thought possible, or maybe possible, but that we never really expected. At least I didn't expect to see commercially. And I do think there can be a little bit of confusion about that sometimes, the mechanism of true biohydrogenation induced milk fat depression versus optimizing milk fat. So are there still farms that struggle with biohydrogenation-induced milk fat depression?
I do agree that I think we have less milk fat depression than what we used to have, and for a number of reasons. Like we aren't feeding as many high-risk diets. I think we're doing a lot better job managing our forages, managing our feeding. As a whole, I think we're doing a better job. We've also been selecting for a cow that has less risk, right? So the geneticists have no idea what they're selecting for. They just know they're selecting for a cow that makes more milk fat during a lactation. And hey, if that cow is susceptible to milk fat depression, she's being selected against. There's no doubt about that, right? But the other one is I really try to challenge people to make sure that they're keeping up with the potential for that herd. So I always say is like, you know, back when we averaged a 3.7, when the herd dropped to a 3.5, I'd be getting a call saying, maybe we have milk fat depression. When they're at a 3.4, the sirens were going off. We have a problem. We have milk fat depression, right? So now we have this cow that's herd that's at a 4.0. So can we call that milk fat depression? It's really hard for me to call a 3.9 a 4.0 milk fat depression. But hey, if you're January 1 and, you know, in our 12-month running average in the north, in the upper Midwest, Northeast is probably like a 4.15 right now, maybe even a little bit higher than that. And if we should be 0.15 above that in January, we should be a 4.3, 4.35. So if you're a 4.0, that's like being a 3.4.
I know. Yeah.
3 years ago, right? So it's hard to have the emotional response to that, I guess you'd say. And you know, we all want to think that we're logical thinkers, but there's a lot of emotion tied to how we respond to things. So I just challenge people is to make sure you're looking, keeping up to what that genetic potential is and your seasonal average. And then let's really look. That's why I like this idea of having that number on the calendar. So this takes a little bit of the emotion out of it. If I have written on the calendar that I should be a 4.3 and I'm a 4.0, I should be going looking for why am I not a 4.3?
Is the mechanism the same? If you're at a 4.0 and you want to be at a 4.0 and you're at a 3.9 versus a 3.5 and a 3.4, or are we looking at different mechanisms?
Yeah, and so what's really interesting, we have a way to know if you have dye-induced milk fat depression that I'm very comfortable with, and that's trans-10-18-1. That's been our marker for dye-induced milk fat depression for 20 years. Problem is you have to do it by GC and it's very slow and inexpensive. So we don't do that on a routine basis, right? So we're still trying to interpret based on milk fat. I do like looking at less than 16, 16 and greater than 16. We have to be careful because that is influenced by the amount of fat you have in the diet. But it gives us another number. So we don't have a lot of herd. We basically don't have herd data to say, on herd level, how many of these herds are going up in trans 10, right? I will say in my experiments, now maybe I'm just a really bad nutritionist and I still have some cows with milk fat depression in our experiments. We get experiments where, you know, you have 20 cows and two of them are clearly milk fat depressed. Even eating the same diet as the rest of the cows in the same barn, whatever's not working for them as far as that diet and their rumen bugs, their rumen fermentation, we still have cows that have high trans 10 values. If we challenge cows and we make diets to challenge cows, we still get high trans 10 and milk fat depression. So the biology still exists there. It still is that variation within a herd. Like I said, I do think that our risk of it has decreased, though. And part of it is when you look at that herd, so you can get a situation where the whole herd or a majority of the herd is tipped into milk fat depression. But then you can also have a scenario that, okay, maybe 5 out of 100 cows have milk fat depression. Now, is that enough an effect on the average for me to see it, right? No, not within the air, right? But hey, if I could help those 5 cows, can I improve my average? Certainly, right? So it goes back to like how do you improve a herd average? Well, you can bring everybody up. But if you look at that cow, if you're averaging a 4.3, you have cows in there at a 4.8, 5.8.
Yeah.
Now, can I help them? It's probably harder to help them than the cow that is at a 3.5, right? So if we can take that 3.5 to a 4.5, that's another way where we can have an effect. So we have to think about a little bit of a different scenario there of helping everybody a little bit versus some of these low cows a lot.
People wondering, I've had some of these conversations like at conferences and with folks out in the field. I think there's a lot of people wondering what's the upper limit on milk fat, because we are seeing some tremendous growth in that area. With what we know right now, what's something that you wish more farms were doing that's like low hanging fruit to maybe bump milk fat up a bit?
That's a really tough question because there's a lot of different opportunities. I think I'm going to go back to just looking at the cows, right? Because I don't want to spend other people's money. There's certainly good supplements out there that can reduce risk for milk fat depression. There's supplements that help in dietary fatty acid supply. But I think as far as a low-hanging fruit, I don't think we think about when we're giving TMR and how that's matching to the daily patterns of those cows. Nobody's selling that, but that's just really good cow management, really good cow sense. I think we could gain by really just watching the cows and thinking about that daily pattern.
Well, anything else before we wrap up, or any other take homes that you want to share with the folks listening?
Yeah, no, nothing comes to mind. It's just like, so from the big picture, our kind of long-term goal is to be able to look at a herd or look at a cow within a herd and actually know why she has a 4.5 milk fat or a 3.5 milk fat and be able to predict that, right? And there's so many different things that go into that, so many different interactions. I think hopefully it's job security for me that we'll keep identifying those. But it is everything from the genetics of that cow, changes across her stage of lactation. I don't think we mentioned that when you're looking at your high group versus your low group, you have to appreciate those are, that's different biology at play. A lot of things going on in the rumen. And, I think we're in a neat spot where we're paid for milk fat and it's something that we can manage. It's very responsive all the way from genetics to management, nutrition. I think that's really a neat place where you have the opportunity to have an impact on something that does actually return some cash to you.
If people want to find out more about what your lab is working on, is there anywhere that they can go?
Yeah, so I just missed being the social media generation. I'm not active on social media. I do appreciate being able to do podcasts for different associations and companies that end up on YouTube. So there's a number of different recordings there. Also like getting out, talking at different nutrition conferences. And then we do publish papers, but that's not as fast of a process as we'd like all the time.
I did have a couple weeks ago, somebody asked me a question about high oleic soybeans. And I was like, I bet Kevin has a talk out there. And I grabbed a recording and threw it back on her email. So yeah,
great.
You're not too hard to find.
It's time for our famous three.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Your partner for extra animal performance, Bergenschmidt Animal Nutrition. Our Yeast 40, ruminal and intestinal double modulation by ICC Animal Nutrition. Accurately measure individual cow feed efficiency with the newest advancement from AffiMilk. Visit AffiMilk.com to learn more. That's AffiMilk.com. Natural Biologics delivers cost-effective solutions to improve health and productivity, helping conquer the rumen health and immunity challenges your animals face. Excellent, a novel product for the management of hypocalcemia. It's uncomplicated excellence. Evonik Animal Nutrition, sciencing the global food challenges. The next giant leap in dairy profitability is here. Introducing AffiColler Feed Efficiency Service from AffiMilk, the first sensor to accurately measure individual cow dry matter intake. Combined individual feed consumption with milk production data to get profitability insights never before available. Hear from producers who are using it to make a big impact on profitability and sustainability at AffiMilk.com.
All right. With that, we'll go ahead and ask you the three questions that all of our guests get asked. And the first one is, what is your favorite dairy-related book or resource?
I think I have to go with a throwback here, and I'm probably going to get the title wrong. There's a very old book by Christie. It's like Lipid Metabolism of the Ruminant Animal. From like, I think the 70s was the first edition of it. And I shouldn't even say this because now a grad student's going to recall the book from the library on me. But I've had the book checked out from the Penn State Library since I got here in 2009.
Oh, wow.
it's always neat to open that up. Very dense read, but it's amazing the details of lipid metabolism that we knew quite a while ago. So, I mean, I think we get into this idea that we're learning new things, and we are, but boy, we've had a lot of knowledge that we've forgotten about. So it's always great to open that up and kind of be humbled a little bit that there's a lot that we've forgotten about lipid metabolism in the cow.
All right. Our second question is, what is your favorite non-dairy related book or resource?
Yeah, I'm going to have to go with Freakonomics podcast on that. I'm not a huge reader outside of reading journal articles. And I have to admit, I've never read the Freakonomics book. I own it, but I haven't read it. But I think I've listened to 98% of the podcast. So I really like their approach. I think it matches a lot to what we do in dairy nutrition, right? Which is to take real world problems, try to get the data that we have and look at it in a impartial way and draw a conclusion and go and see if it works or not in the real world. So I really like their series of podcasts.
I'll listen to more of those. I have a colleague here that will just drop Freakonomics episodes all the time, be like, oh, I've listened to a Freakonomics episode about that. And I always think, I got to get caught up on those. But yes, good one. I think that's a first. Usually we have a lot of repeats on these questions. I think that's a first on Freakonomics, at least for me. But all right. And so our last question is, what do you think sets successful dairy professionals apart from those that are not successful?
Yeah, so I hate to answer this of what makes people successful or not, because I have no idea how to evaluate that. I'll say what I would answer is that the folks that I really enjoy working with are the folks that are inquisitive in asking questions and really conducting what Mike Allen used to call the nutrition's experiment and practice. And I think really as nutritionists and managers, you know, I do formal experiments in academia, but nutritionists in the real world are always doing experiments. Like, what about this? Can I change this and get a response? And those are the people I really like talking with in interacting with. I really don't believe anybody that thinks they have it all figured out, because I think the biology is a bit too complicated for us to ever figure it all out.
Yes. Well, it's job security too, right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Harbateen, for joining us on this episode of the Dairy Podcast Show. Thank you to our listeners. And at that, we will end recording.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.